Welcome back to Sermons. We finished up Exodus last time, which in part dealt with the creation of the Ark of the Covenant. And this time we're going to begin to investigate just what happened to the Ark. You know, how it became the lost Ark. And where somebody might need to go to find it. You know, if you're doing an Indiana Jones thing or a Nazi thing, looking for religious artifacts. The music you just heard was the arrival of the Queen of Sheba from Act 3 of Handel's Solomon Oratorio, and it was performed by the accordion ensemble Arte and played here under a Creative Commons Attribution Sharealike 4.0 license. This music wasn't written for the accordion, of course. Handel originally composed it for strings and oboes and so on, but I couldn't find any orchestral performances that weren't protected by copyright, so the accordion version will have to do. It'll be our new theme music for a while. But the arrival of the Queen of Sheba refers to a passage in 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, and also 2 Chronicles chapter 9, verse 1, which reads almost identically. They just divided the verses differently. Here's the 2 Chronicles version. And when the Queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon, she came to prove Solomon with hard questions at Jerusalem, with a very great company, and camels that bear spices, and gold in abundance, and precious stones. And when she was come to Solomon, she communed with him of all that was in her heart. So, who were these two? The Queen of Sheba and Solomon, King Solomon. You know, Solomon was the son of King David, or David, it was probably pronounced back then, and he became the new king of Israel when David passed on. You know, there were some girls in my French and German classes in high school that used to call me David, but it didn't stick, thank goodness. Otherwise, I'd be known today as Dav in Kentucky. It had been King David's ambition to build a great temple to become the permanent home of the Ark of the Covenant and the other artifacts that during the Exodus, they had only had a mobile home called the Tabernacle. But because of some infractions against the Yahwehlians, David was not allowed to build this temple. But Solomon was allowed to fulfill his father's dream, and it was during the construction of Solomon's temple that the visit from the Queen of Sheba took place. Now, where was the land of Sheba? Well, the consensus seems to be that it included parts of modern-day Yemen, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. And of these three countries, Ethiopia has the most extensive tradition claiming that the Queen of Sheba was their former queen. There's an Ethiopian holy book called the Kebra Nagast that gives a very detailed account of what led up to the Queen of Sheba's visit to Solomon, as well as of the visit itself and its aftermath, including the story of what happened to the Ark and where it may be today. We've digressed into these Ethiopian texts once before, specifically the Book of Enoch, way back in sermons number 3 and 4. Now, the Book of Enoch is considered a canonical part of the Bible by the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, but the Kebra Nagast is not. But it is still considered a holy book. You can find the complete book on archive.org under the title The Queen of Sheba and Her Only Son Menelik. And by the way, the Queen of Sheba's name is given in this book as Makeda. I used to know a girl named Markeda with an R when I was a kid. She's the one that taught me how to do the twist. I don't know how she came to be named Markeda. But she had a mother named Vogel, and she had a sister named Cricket, although that may have probably been a nickname. So I guess unusual names ran in the family. The subtitle of the Kebra Nagast says, Being the History of the Departure of God and His Ark of the Covenant from Jerusalem to Ethiopia, and the Establishment of the Religion of the Hebrews and the Solomonic Line of Kings in that country. Below that it says, A Complete Translation of the Kebra Nagast, with introduction by Sir E. A. Wallace Budge. And it lists his degrees. An M.A., which used to mean something a long time ago. Three different Doctor of Letters degrees. This is F.S.A., and I believe that stands for Fellow of the Society of Antiquaries. And it notes that he is a sometime scholar of Christ's College, Cambridge, and Tyrwhitt Hebrew scholar. Oh gosh. Keeper of the Department of Egyptian and Assyrian Antiquities in the British Museum. So this E.A. Wallace Budge is to the Kebra Nagast what R.A. Charles was to the Book of Enoch and to several other apocryphal texts or pseudepigraphal texts. Now the next page shows dates for the first edition and a reprint, both of which are in 1922. And since that's over 100 years ago, the book is now in the public domain, so I don't have to worry about reading extended passages from it. There's a long preface and an even longer introduction, but I'll only read you a little bit from the beginning of the introduction because I want to get right into the primary source material. The intro starts out, The Kebra Nagast, or the Book of the Glory of the Kings of Ethiopia, has been held in the highest esteem and honor throughout the length and breadth of Abyssinia for 1,000 years at least. And even today it is believed by every educated man in that country to contain the true history of the origin of the Solomonic line of kings in Ethiopia, and is regarded as the final authority on the history of the conversion of the Ethiopians from the worship of the sun, moon, and stars to that of the Lord God of Israel. Now, in the first 16 chapters of the Kebra Nagast, we get a recap of the Old Testament up to this point, kind of a previously on this program segment. And then in chapter 17, we get the stuff about the creation of the Ark. I'll read part of that. And as concerning Zion, the tabernacle of the law of God, at the very beginning, as soon as God had established the heavens, he ordained that it should become the habitation of his glory upon the earth. And willing this, he brought it down to the earth and permitted Moses to make a likeness of it. And he said unto him, Make an ark or tabernacle of wood that cannot be eaten by worms, and overlay it with pure gold. Now, I think there's a misunderstanding in the translation here. We've seen that the tabernacle is the big mobile home, you know, with the big top tent, where the ark resides, not the ark itself. But in the Kebra Nagast, the words tabernacle and ark are pretty much interchangeable. So keep that in mind if we run over that word again. And thou shalt place therein the word of the law, which is the covenant that I have written with mine own fingers, that they may keep my law, the two tables of the covenant. And the two tables of the covenant are the two stone tablets or tables containing the Ten Commandments. Maybe the Ten Commandments. Maybe something else. We don't know for sure. It also says that the ark contains a quantity of gold, a sample of manna, and the rod of Aaron, which was now actually three rods since it had been broken in two places. And the chapter goes on to talk about the ark being covered with gold and about the rings and the poles to carry it with and how the Israelites carried it before them when they moved from place to place or went into battle and about some of the seemingly miraculous events that happened as a result. Then in chapter 21, it begins to talk about the Queen of Sheba, which it calls either the Queen of the South or the Queen of Ethiopia, interchangeably. And it says, "And the Queen of the South was very beautiful in face, and her stature was superb, and her understanding and intelligence, which God had given her, were of such high character that she went to Jerusalem to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Now this was done by the command of God, and it was his good pleasure. And moreover, she was exceedingly rich, for God had given her glory and riches and gold and silver and splendid apparel and camels and slaves and trading men or merchants." So she went to Jerusalem to hear the wisdom of Solomon, because, as she explained in chapter 24, "For I desire wisdom, and my heart seeketh to find understanding. I am smitten with the love of wisdom." And she was soon to be smitten with the love of Solomon. In fact, she was pretty much sold on him before she ever laid eyes on him. She said, "And I love him merely on hearing concerning him, and without seeing him. And the whole story of him that hath been told me is to me as the desire of my heart, and like water to the thirsty man." Now, this is totally different from the movie Solomon and Sheba that I watched recently. It's the 1959 movie with Yul Brynner, back when he had hair, and Gina Lollobrigida, back when she had all of her pleasing attributes. And you're going to say, "Now, wait a minute. Gina Lollobrigida doesn't look Ethiopian." And you'd be right. But then Alexander Hamilton wasn't a black man either, so what's your point? Anyway, Yemen claims the queen came from their country, and they're not predominantly black. But then Gina Lollobrigida doesn't really look Arab either. So if you want a dark-skinned Queen of Sheba, you can watch one of the TV movies that, Halle Berry made one, and Vivica Fox made another one in the 90s. They should be easy enough to find. But I enjoyed Gina Lollobrigida as the queen, despite the fact that, unlike the real Makeda, her character wasn't sold on Solomon from the outset. She was a schemer who was trying to figure out his weakness so she could destroy him. Well, spoiler alert, she didn't fully destroy him anyway. But this movie did destroy Tyrone Power. He was going to play Solomon originally, and they filmed a bunch of his scenes, but he had a massive heart attack while he was filming a sword fight scene, and he died. So all of his scenes had to be reshot with Yul Brynner in the role. But anyway, back to the Kebra Nagast. Queen Makeda made ready with great pomp and majesty and with great equipment and many preparations, and set off for Jerusalem in a caravan of almost 800 camels, plus innumerable mules and asses. Now, this is where we came in, back in 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles. So let's go back and read the few verses that remain of what the Bible tells us about the Queen of Sheba's visit. I'll read the 1 Kings version this time, although 2 Chronicles is almost the same thing. But I'll start in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 2. "And she came to Jerusalem with a very great train, with camels that bear spices, and very much gold, and precious stones. And when she was come to Solomon, she communed with him of all that was in her heart. And Solomon told her all her questions. There was not anything hid from the king, which he told her not. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all Solomon's wisdom, and the house that he had built," that's the temple, "and the meat of his table, and the sitting of his servants, and the attendance of his ministers, and their apparel, and his cupbearers, and his ascent by which he went up into the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. And she said to the king, "It was a true report that I heard in mine own land of thy acts and of thy wisdom. Howbeit I believed not the words until I came, and mine eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Thy wisdom and prosperity exceedeth the fame which I heard. Happy are thy men, happy are these thy servants, which stand continually before thee, and that hear thy wisdom. Blessed be the Lord thy God, which delighted in thee to set thee on the throne of Israel, because the Lord loved Israel forever. Therefore made he thee king to do judgment and justice." And she gave the king 120 talents of gold, and of spices very great store, and precious stones. There came no more such abundance of spices as those which the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. And that's basically it for the biblical version of the story, but the Kebron Agast gives a much more complete version in chapter 25. And I'm going to read almost that whole chapter. "And she arrived in Jerusalem and brought to the king very many precious gifts, which he desired to possess greatly. And he paid her great honor and rejoiced, and he gave her a habitation in the royal palace near him. And he sent her food both for the morning and evening meal." And then it goes into all the fine foods that he provided for these meals. Each one enough to feed 350 people, which I suppose was the size of her entourage. "And every day he arrayed her in 11 garments which bewitched the eyes. And he visited her and was gratified, and she visited him and was gratified." Now, I'm taking this to be merely intellectual gratification at this point. "And she saw his wisdom, and his just judgments, and his splendor, and his grace, and heard the eloquence of his speech. And she marveled in her heart, and was utterly astonished in her mind. And she recognized in her understanding, and perceived very clearly with her eyes how admirable he was. And she wondered exceedingly because of what she saw and heard with him, how perfect he was in composure, and wise in understanding, and pleasant in graciousness, and commanding in stature. And she observed the subtlety of his voice, and the discreet utterances of his lips, and that he gave his commands with dignity, and that his replies were made quietly and with the fear of God. All these things she saw, and she was astonished at the abundance of his wisdom, and there was nothing whatsoever wanting in his word and speech, but everything that he spake was perfect. And Solomon was working at the building of the house of God," that's the temple, "and he rose up and went to the right and to the left, and forward and backward. And he showed the workmen the measurement and weight and the space covered by the materials. And he told the workers in metal how to use the hammer and the drill and the chisel. And he showed the stonemasons the angle measure and the circle and the surface measure. And everything was wrought by his order, and there was none who set himself in opposition to his word. For the light of his heart was like a lamp in the darkness, and his wisdom was as abundant as the sand." So he took a hands-on approach to supervising the building of the temple, you know, the new home of the Ark of the Covenant. And the Queen of Sheba was witness to all this, and she had to be impressed by his practical knowledge and ability, as well as by his wisdom. He was a man's man, as well as a godly man and a ladies' man. And when I say ladies' man, I'm thinking of the 11th chapter of 1 Kings, which begins, "But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites." So when he said he was going to get him some strange, he really meant it. These were strange women. Solomon kind of reminds me of Captain Kirk going after all those green-skinned alien women. Of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Turned away his heart from the Yahweh Elohim, that is, and toward their strange gods. You know, it mentions the daughter of Pharaoh, who worshipped the Egyptian god Amun. You know, she and Solomon had an arranged marriage for the purpose of creating an alliance between Egypt and Israel. But the Queen of Sheba apparently converted to the Hebrew religion. In chapter 28 of the Kebra Nagast, she tells Solomon, from this moment I will not worship the sun, but will worship the creator of the sun, the God of Israel. See, by this time, the conflation of the original creator Elohim with the later Yahweh Elohim had already been established. So they're calling the Yahweh Elohim the creator of the sun, even though they weren't. They were the creators of mankind. Chapter 28 goes on to say that after 6 months, the queen wished to return to her own country. And she sent a message to Solomon saying, I desire greatly to dwell with thee, but now for the sake of all my people, I wish to return to my own country. And up to this point, their relationship had been platonic. But now Solomon gets to thinking. He pondered in his heart and said, a woman of such splendid beauty hath come to me from the ends of the earth. What do I know? Will God give me seed in her? Now, as it is said in the book of Kings, Solomon the king was a lover of women. And he married wives of the Hebrews and the Egyptians and the Canaanites and the Edomites. And several more here that I don't know how to pronounce. And women who were reported to be beautiful. And he had 400 queens and 600 concubines. Well, that doesn't match up. So this author has different criteria for the difference between a wife and a concubine. Because, but at least the total of the two numbers matches the total given in 1 Kings. Now this which he did was not for the sake of fornication. Of course not. But as a result of the wise intent that God had given unto him, and his remembering what God had said unto Abraham, I will make thy seed like the stars of heaven for number, and like the sand of the sea. So he was just wanting to be fruitful and multiply, that's all. It was the will of God. Wasn't that he was horny or anything. Chapters 29 and 30 of the Kebra Nagast tell the story of how King Solomon seduced the Queen of Sheba sometime before she left for home. They had a heavy meal, which made her sleepy, and he invited her to take thou thine ease here for love's sake until daybreak. In his own quarters, see. But before she would agree, she made him swear not to seduce her during the night. For if I, who according to the law of men am a maiden, be seduced, I shall travel on my journey back in sorrow and affliction and tribulation. Well, sly devil that he was, Solomon swore that he wouldn't take her virginity if she would swear not to take anything that wasn't hers during the night. So they both swore that oath and went to bed. But he knew that she'd get thirsty during the night because he had served her, among other things, drinks that were mingled with vinegar and fish and dishes made with pepper. But before he retired, he made sure that there was a pitcher of water beside his bed, but not beside hers. So when she woke up during the night, her mouth was so dry she couldn't spit. So she got up and padded across the room on her bare feet to get a drink from his pitcher. But in doing that, she violated her oath, and he caught her doing it and called her on it. Which kind of surprised her. "Is my oath broken by my drinking water?" she said. And the king said unto her, "Is there anything that thou hast seen under the heavens that is better than water?" The wisdom of Solomon. Then Solomon said unto her, "Am I perchance free from the oath which thou hast made me swear?" And the queen said, "Be free from thy oath, only let me drink water." And he permitted her to drink water. And after she had drunk water, he worked his will with her, and they slept together. So yeah, it was a dirty trick. But just because he was technically allowed to put the moves on her didn't mean she had to give in, you know. But she was like, "Yeah, you caught me stealing your water, so I guess I got to give you what you want," wink, wink. You know, she loved him before she met him, remember. So she'd been wanting him for a while. She gave in because she wanted to. And she did a lot more giving in before she went home, as we'll see next time. And until then, keep the faith, but watch out for that spicy food and those spicy Bible stories.
Thank you.